You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and it is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines this last week. And our panel today, Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Ed News, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, and Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. Hi, everybody.
Happy Hello. Friday.
Hi.
Happy Friday. So, some developing news before we get to election coverage. And this is in regards to the governor leaving the state for a few days. I mean, normally that's not a very big deal. It happens. But apparently did not notify the lieutenant governor of this. So I would like all of you to weigh in on this. But Kelsey, I want to start with you, because how were you made aware of this?
This is something I heard about this morning, because my mother-in-law works in Atlanta sometimes. She works remotely most of the time, but she goes there occasionally. And she was on a direct flight back to Boise from Atlanta and said that she saw Governor Little on her plane. And so I thought to myself, that's interesting, because I didn't hear that he was leaving the state. And this has been kind of an ongoing drama between Governor Little and Lieutenant Governor McKeon. So I think this is the first time that I'm aware of that he has not said something to her along the lines of, I'm leaving the state. So yeah, I heard this was coming, I think.
And with that said, though, Lieutenant Governor Janice McKeon put out a news release this morning saying basically that he can't do that, correct? Like it's against the Idaho Constitution.
Yeah, and that's kind of an outstanding question. The governor's office asked the attorney general to form an opinion on this matter, because it's become such an issue where she's kind of taking the code and running with it to decide that she can, you know, do whatever she wants as governor when he's gone, because the Constitution says that she serves as acting governor in his absence. But it sounds like that's something that might have to be decided by the courts, because it's not really clear in Idaho code whether that's the case or not. Mm-hmm. Especially in today's world, I mean, it's pretty easy to stay in touch with the governor when he's out of state. So it's not technically that he's absent, just out of the state.
Right. And the last time, I believe, Kelsey, that he left this state, the lieutenant governor, frankly, made national headlines with some things that she did. So,
at this point,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. last time she talked about putting out the National Guard and sending them to the border. So it's been a pretty big, big moves that she's tried to make when he's out of state.
Yeah.
To your point.
So Kelsey, at this point, then we're just, I mean, so we know he left the state. We know he didn't notify the lieutenant governor. She puts out this news release saying that it violated the Constitution. Where do we go from here?
I am not sure. Because even the code that she cites doesn't say that he has to notify her. It just says that she's acting governor during his absence from the state. So, you know, I think this is going to be something that the attorney general we'll have to weigh in on, and then potentially it goes to court. I'm not sure. But these are two people who are presumably running against each other for the governor's seat in March or May. So we have to take that into consideration as well. This is all very campaign related.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Let's move on to, let's go back a few days to Tuesday, which was election day, because we had mayoral races, we had levies, we had school board elections. Margaret, I want to start with city council races, in particular in Boise, because one of these races in particular, frankly, got pretty ugly and personal towards the end.
Yeah, so we had a really interesting day on Tuesday. Three city council members' seats were up. The race that you're referring to is District 3, which was city council member Lisa Sanchez's district. She had three challengers. The front runner who raised the most money was real estate agent Greg McMillan, and he raised quite a lot of money. It was over $40,000, which is roughly the same amount that Sanchez raised. I haven't looked at the final totals, but when I looked at the most recent reports in mid-October, they were neck and neck with over $40,000. And his campaign never ran negative ads themselves. You know, they stayed focused on his support for first responders, and they really emphasized that he was local and he was independent, but he was backed by some PACs that were running ugly ads against Sanchez. And some people have criticized McMillan for not condemning some of the negative ads. She had, there were ads linking her to defunding the police, pictures of her mugshot on mailers. She was arrested. That's from when she was arrested at the Idaho State Capitol protesting ad for the Add the Words movement back in 2015, I believe. And, you know, linking her to crazy wokeness. It was the same pack. One of the packs was the Conservative Citizens for Thoughtful Growth. That's the same pack that ran attack ads against Diana Lacciando last year. It's funded by home builders. And the other pack was the Responsible Government Fund, which ran negative ads against Mayor McLean in the 2019 race, that had, that linked her to, that falsely linked her to supporting homeless encampments. It had pictures of the mayor in front of pictures of Cooper Court, the infamous homeless encampment that was that sprung up around the same time back in 2015. And that group was funded by also funded by developers, namely David Wally, but they also, he was the head of the pack, but they also got donations from all kinds of other developers, including one of the organizers of the recall campaign for Lisa Sanchez and Mayor McLean. So it, you know, it got pretty personal, but at the end of the night, Sanchez cleaned up. She won all but three precincts. Over, you know, I can't remember the exact percentage, but it was closing in on or higher than 60%. You know, she took a commanding lead from the beginning, and McMillan never really made up that ground as the day of elections rolled in. I think that I've heard from some voters that they chose to vote for her because of the negative ads, and they felt they saw some of the negative attack ads and things, especially, you know, Democrats were really activated by materials from the Ada County Republicans. But at the end of the day, it's important to remember that that's a very liberal leaning district. You do the numbers, and there were only so many non-Democrat voters in that district. So that's what happened over there.
Okay. And Kevin, we've talked about this quite a bit on Idaho Matters in the past. And this is the fact that there were a good amount of school board seats up for grabs all across the state. In fact, you were on the show, on election day to talk about this. So what happened in those races? And maybe we can bring it down to, I mean, you know, the Treasure Valley, but quite a few positions, as we mentioned, all across the state.
Really, really interesting results, Gemma. Let's start with the Treasure Valley, because you had open races in West Ada and Nampa, and the more conservative candidates swept all of those races. So you have new trustees, two new trustees in West Ada who campaigned against mask mandates in schools. You have three, you know, conservative-leaning candidates now in Nampa, all sweeping into these open seats. We'll see how that all plays out. You know, our Blake Jones talked to the two new West Ada trustee elects and one of the Nampa trustees elect to get a sense of what they're going to try to do. And these are the kind of elections that could really kind of swing the balance of power within a school board. I mean, there are only five school board members. So you flip a couple of seats, it could really change not just policies on mask mandates, or policies on critical race theory, which were the talking points in these elections. It could really change the way these election, the way these school districts operate. Overall, let me just kind of take a step back to talk about what happened statewide. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to draw really sweeping conclusions about what happened in these school board elections, because while clearly conservatives had a good night in West Ada and Nampa, the results are a little bit all over the map. The Kootenai County Republicans were very active. They endorsed 11 candidates in that area. and not all of them won. They didn't get a sweep in any school district up there. David Riley, a candidate we've talked about before, Post Falls candidate who had some really nasty anti-Semitic tweets on his account, which he had later deleted, but nothing ever was really completely deleted or forgotten on Twitter. He lost. You had two members of Lieutenant Governor McGeehan's Education Task Force running for trustee races in Eastern Idaho. They both lost, and they both lost really big. I mean, they barely got like a third of the vote in their races. So it's hard to say what happened. And these are such local races. I mean, when you talk about a school board race in Blackfoot, where a task force member Sonia Harris lost, or Sugar Salem, where a task force member Elaine King lost, these are such small races, they're such localized races. And you know, when you're not on the ground, it's really hard to tell what other variables are affecting the results. But my takeaway, it's hard to definitively say this was a sweep for conservatives or not. A lot of turnover though, 21 incumbent school board members across the state lost. So you factor that turnover on top of the incumbents who decided not to run, there are gonna be a lot of new trustees making a lot of very important decisions in school districts across the state.
Yeah. And Margaret, before we move on to the sewer bond that was on the ballot in Ada County, we should also mention that when with these city council races in Boise, when you were talking about that, this was also the first time, though, that not everyone in the city got to vote for city council candidates. I know, like in my own district, the only thing I had to vote for was the sewer bond. So this also, I mean, may have played into, in frankly, into how people, and who got elected potentially.
Yeah. So this year we had only half the city was able to vote for a city council person. There was a district in West Boise where Republican Lucy Willis did very well over former Democratic state legislator candidate Laura Metzler. And then there was District 5, which encompassed downtown Boise, the East End, part of the bench, and incumbent Councilmember Holly Woodings also did very well. She had three challengers, but still, you know, she closed in at just under 50% of the vote. There were many people in the city of Boise who were not able to vote. I heard there was some confusion, people coming to their precinct and not seeing a city council member on the ballot. That's going to be an uphill battle, I think, for people to get the word out as we transition to that, especially this year where we only had the bond. And then if you lived in the West Boise sewer district, you didn't even get to vote for the bond. And if you didn't have a city council district, you couldn't cast a vote at all.
Right. And so then the sewer bond itself though, Margaret, passed pretty handily, did it not?
Oh, yeah. That sewer bond, I think, exceeded anyone's expectations of how it was going to do. Over 75% of voters gave that a thumbs up. And that is a program that basically allowed the city to borrow up to $570 million to do repairs to Boise's aging sewer system, build some new facilities to encompass growth, and to start a water recycling program. And so I've written a lot about this. I'm going to continue writing about it. There's so many interesting moving parts here. And I think that there were some people who I saw on social media who were, kind of criticizing that the city held this bond whenever there was only, half the city council districts up. But here's the thing, that was one of the criticisms of shifting to districts is that, yes, we're going to have all six seats up next year because as we make that transition to a new map and we make the transition to districting going forward. But other than 2023, in perpetuity, Every election is now going to be an election where half the city can't vote and for bond measures, except for a bond measure. And so that's really going to change the game. And it's going to make it harder in certain ways, I would think, to activate certain voters, because, I think that people who are really dedicated municipal watchers, they're going to show up and they're going to be engaged on a bond. But usually what gets people out to an election is they come out for a candidate. And so I'm going to be really interested to see how that's going to change bonds, how that's going to change, you know, any, if we have another ballot, more ballot initiatives, all sorts of things. And so that's something to watch. But I will say, turnout did not suffer because of those districts. So we had, you know, 2017, the last year we had an off year where there was no mayor on the ballot. Turnout was only citywide 20%. And this year we, you know, bested 25%, and it climbed up even higher in District 3, where over 10,000 ballots were cast in the North End and Northwest Boise alone. And so I think that Tuesday night was a real repudiation of people's arguments that if things are split into districts, people won't come out and vote. And but also, I think that that speaks to the fact that we had people spending a lot of money, people putting out a lot of ads. We saw text ads, mailers, Facebook ads, phone banking, door knocking, massive billboards on State Street. If you lived in District 3, I guarantee you, you had at least one candidate contact you once, if not multiple times, if not multiple candidates. And so I'm going to be super interested to see how we keep going on that transition and how Boiseans feel about the districts, because I've talked to some people who are pretty salty about the fact that they didn't get to vote. And they now have say over 1/6 of the council.
Well, and Margaret, what are your thoughts on the fact that, I mean, yes, it was good voter turnout, but it may go back to the fact that if you are not someone who is watching this constantly and realizing that we now vote in districts in the city of Boise, you may have come out expecting to vote for these candidates. And then you get there and, you know, there's a sewer bond, or, you know, if you're in West Ada, there's nothing. I mean, there was one district that had nothing to vote for. So I do think you're right. It's going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out over the next couple of years.
Right. And education and getting the word out about municipal topics, all sorts of topics, is always a struggle. I mean, as a reporter, I think everyone that is on this show right now has had someone in their inbox or call them on the phone and say, why did no one tell me about insert bond election, insert any topic? Why did no one tell me? And the thing is, you know, it is hard to get the word out, because I think there's, especially now, where people have so many sources of information that they're looking at, people tend to be looking at national news a lot of times instead of the local news. You know, it's like, well, we wrote 20 stories on it, you know, but if you're not going to, you know, like, if you're not going to be putting certain local news things in your feed or taking a look at them, you know, it's hard to get people to get into a place where they're going to physically see that information, because, you know, I'm not the town crier. I'm not going to knock on your door and say, hey, there's an election and here's how it works, you know? And so bridging that gap, and that's where really good audience work and news comes in, bridging that gap of, okay, so I've written 20 stories that explain how this district works and this bond works, or who can vote and who can't vote. But how do I get that information in front of the people that need to know? And that is always going to be the struggle. And so no matter what issue, we're always going to have people come out and are confused and they don't know how things work. And so every day as a reporter, I feel like I'm always sitting there going, how do I reach more people? How do I reach more people? And that's always going to be a struggle, especially now that we're operating under a new municipal election system.
And just a really quick personal anecdote, as I was going to my polling place, I live in West Boise, I saw a big Lucy Willits sign on the thoroughfare. And when I got to the polling place, you know, I'm not in that council district. The only thing that was on my ballot was the sewer bond. So I can see how that confusion is just, it's going to be hard to overcome it.
Margaret, I agree. As a town crier?
I was just going to say that. I think Margaret, you would be a great town crier. Just saying. Listen, all right, we got to.
I was not a theater kid for nothing. I need, one day I'm going to use those skills.
I can't wait for it. We got to take a quick break. We'll have more next. Continuing our reporter roundtable, our panel today, Mark Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley Morris with Idaho Capital Sun, and Kevin Richert, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Ed News. Kelsey, talk to us about the possibility of getting rid of supplemental levies to fund public schools around the state.
Yeah, this is a proposal that came from Senator Jim Rice of Caldwell that he has kind of floated in the past, but hasn't really gone anywhere yet. It's coming out of the study committee on property tax, the property taxes and revenue expenditures in the legislature, which is kind of an interim study committee that's trying to find ways to ease property taxes on Idaho residents. So his idea is to take 0.5 cent of sales tax revenue off the top of the general fund and allocate it to a separate dedicated fund that would be distributed to Idaho schools based on their number of enrolled students. And the goal of that is to eventually get rid of the option to use supplemental levies at all to make up those funding gaps for schools, which is how they're currently used, in part because in 2006, there was a tax shift that was sort of similar that was meant to provide property tax relief, and it ended up causing serious problems for schools to try to fund their general operations. And so these levies have been something that is kind of essential now, not supplemental, if you ask any person in the schools who are in charge of those operations. And the supplemental levies last year across the state, I think they were used in, I think I said 80% of Idaho's 115 school districts, which amounts to about $216 million, and this proposal would only net about $180 million starting out, but he would allow school districts, or this proposal would allow school districts to levy for that difference while the fund grows based on sales tax growth from the economy. So it's gotten some criticism that it would, you know, not fund education adequately still, and it would take away the tool from voters to, you know, make up those gaps that schools say they need.
And Kevin, I want to talk about Boise State University for a bit, because for the first time in its history, the majority of incoming students are not from the state of Idaho.
Right. So I've been asking for enrollment numbers, and those numbers came through from Boise State a few days ago, and it really is interesting. So what we had for the first time in this university's 89-year history, more of the first-year undergraduate students, the new arrivals, are coming from out of state as opposed to in-state. Now, what that means is, it means that the demographics of Boise State University are changing and continue to change. I've written about this in the past, that part of what helped Boise State get through the pandemic and the enrollment drops that they saw with in-state enrollment was that they had more students coming in from out of state last year during the pandemic. So this is just continuing, and it's really continuing across the board. You have more out-of-state students, whether you look at undergrads, graduate students, transfer students. It just cuts across the entire student population. And from a policy end, one of the things that Boise State is talking about doing now is that they're talking about the need to kind of funnel their scholarship aid in directions so that it's not just going out, you know, based on merit alone. What they want to do is look at, you know, how do we get more in-state students? How do we get more rural students? How do we attract those student groups onto campus? Because right now they're not coming. And that's not just a Boise State problem. You know, schools across the country are seeing just fewer rural students showing up in college. And the pandemic is obviously a key factor in that.
But Kevin, what's interesting to me with this, though, is that with Boise State's location, and what I mean by that is being in the largest city in the state, right? And yes, you may not be attracting as many rural students, but if you're the majority of your students are coming from outside of the state, that also means your most populous city is also not attracting students to this university.
Right. But, you know, one of the things that Boise State was saying to me as I was doing this story was they pointed out that regardless of where these students come from, whether they're from in-state or out-of-state, about two-thirds of the graduates actually do wind up staying in Idaho. So on the one hand, no, you're not seeing as many in-state students coming to campus. But on the other hand, these students who are coming in from out-of-state, coming here for affordability reasons, by the way, a lot of them wind up staying and they wind up working in, you know, in fields where employers are having a hard time finding workers.
And Margaret, I want to also talk about a big issue also facing BSU. And this is a lack of housing for students.
Yes. So I've been writing about this for a couple years now. It is hard to find a place to live if you're a Boise State student. For many years, Boise State was not a school where people usually lived in a dorm. It was a big commuter school. And that started all changing in the last 10 or 15 years as more and more the school got more popular, more and more students started coming in from other places in Idaho and out of state, and they need a place to live. And the school has had a hard time keeping up with the amount of dorm space that it needs. And so right now they actually put out an RFP trying to rent space for 70 beds. And this is a drop in the bucket because a consultant recently found that the school is short roughly 750 beds that they need to accommodate graduate students and particularly first year students. And that is a really tough number to overcome. They're looking at having a new dorm coming online in the next 3 years, but that's going, you know, with a couple hundred beds. But school officials estimate by the time they build that dorm, they'll be behind again. And another big reason they're behind is it's a combination of students not commuting the way they did before, and there's just fewer traditional living options near campus. A lot of times they're used to just be, people just didn't have as much difficulty finding an affordable place to live. You could just find, a simple house south of campus, rent it with a couple friends, and you're good. But now as more and more people have flooded into Boise, they're looking for real estate to buy. They're looking for things. And that neighborhood south of Boise State was a lower cost neighborhood. And so that is a high risk for people, you know, speculating. Lower cost real estate in a high value market, people love to buy it. And then that's further complicated by the fact that there's some of these luxury properties that are coming on, you know, that are bringing a lot of beds, like Identity and the new project that I've written about a lot, that's going to displace the Reidenbaugh apartments on Boise Avenue and Protest. That's going to bring in a lot of beds, but those are high cost beds, you know, luxury type things with a pool and a gym and all sorts of other amenities. And also that's not suitable for someone who's 18. If you're a parent with a freshman, you want to know that your kid is going to have a dorm. And if you're looking at comparable state universities and you find out that Boise State can't guarantee you a bed, you know, in a dorm on campus with an RA and a meal, a dining hall, that's the word I was looking for, you're probably going to want to go elsewhere. And so the university is kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, and the locals who live in that neighborhood who are having more and more pressure from developers that are developing student housing over, you know, housing that is traditionally for families or young professors, they're feeling the crunch too.
And another reason this is important, I just want to interject. University officials will tell you that freshmen, first-year students, when they live on campus as opposed to living off campus somewhere, they tend to do better. Their grades are higher.
Well, and in some universities, at least like where I went to school, it was a qualification. I mean, it was mandatory that you lived on campus your freshman year, and because of that, we have to take a break. But really quickly, Kevin, before we do, since we've been talking about the housing issue at Boise State, I think it's also important to talk about the fact that not only is there a lack of housing, but Kevin, as Margaret mentioned, a lot of these kids can't afford housing to the point where there is a homelessness issue.
There is. And that whole affordability issue, and that goes back to what I was talking about with the in-state versus out-of-state students. Boise State is concerned that right now, in-state students find Boise State, you know, in college in general in Idaho to be out of their price range. Whereas these out-of-state students, even though they're having to pay out-of-state tuition rates, are looking at the numbers to go to Idaho and say, well, it's cheaper than staying in my home state. It's a really interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, it really is. Go ahead, Margaret.
Super quick, you know, something that I wrote about pre-pandemic was some Boise State students put together a special, some engineering students, they created an app that will basically alert nearby students when there's free food. And they talked That's about right. how many yeah. people they know who are food insecure as college students and can benefit from having, from showing up and getting the leftover catering food from an event or something like that. And I think that the fact that that was in such demand that students developed that and they were using it says a lot about where these students are right now. And that's not just undergrads, that's graduate students who are paid, but they are paid a very low stipend. Mm-hmm.
Kelsey, we've been talking about elections, but we've, mentioned at the top of the show that we have a primary election coming up, in May, 6 months away, but already a lot of money is being raised by candidates.
Yeah. And, a lot of it is just being raised by Governor Little. And in fact, I kind of think that's probably what he was doing when he was out of state. And it's probably going to be an ongoing issue because he is heavily fundraising. About 600,000 of it, as of that writing last week, was from Governor Little's campaign. And he has not officially announced, but he's definitely doing the work. So that was compared to Lieutenant Governor McGeehan's haul of about 105,000. And so he's outspending them about 5-1 right now. And outraising, I guess, is the better terminology. But it's about 1.6 million that all of these candidates have raised so far. And it's they don't officially file until, I think, March. So we're still pretty far out. And it's an indication of how competitive these races are going to be. The lieutenant governor race is between three current and former legislators. Former legislator Luke Malik, current Representative Priscilla Giddings, and Speaker of the House Scott Bedke, and they're all kind of running pretty close to each other in terms of their fundraising abilities. Mm-hmm. So that race is going to be pretty contested, as well as Secretary of State. Representative Dorothy Moon of Sanley just got in that race on I think it was Monday or Tuesday, and I found that through my campaign finance upkeep on the records, because we're going to be updating those pretty regularly throughout the election. So if you ever want to see exactly who's being donating to whom and what the date was and where they're from, that's all going to be in the tables that I've put in that article on the Idaho Capital Zone website. So we'll be able to keep track of that as they go.
Okay, because you're right. I mean, this is going to be an interesting couple of interesting races to watch for sure. I mean, to put it very mildly. Kevin, I know we were talking about Boise State and issues going on there with students, et cetera. But I also wanted to get the latest on a lawsuit that Big City Coffee filed against the university.
Well, yeah. So first, can I just loop back really quickly? I mean, Kelsey's done a great job of putting together this spreadsheet looking at the campaign contributions. And it's really all we've got, all she's got, are kind of an incomplete picture, because all the candidates have to report right now are big donations of $1,000 or more. So
true.
Stay tuned, because by the end of the year, when they have to report every donation, we'll have a much better picture of just how expensive these races are going to be. Anyway, yes, Boise State lawsuit. Boise State last week went to court seeking a dismissal of this $10 million plus lawsuit that was filed by Big City Coffee. You recall that Big City Coffee had a location on campus last fall, didn't last, only spent a few weeks there. Depending on who you believe, they were either forced off of campus or they just decided to leave campus. That's been the university's contention. What Boise State is basically saying in its motion for dismissal, and Margaret wrote about this too, is they're basically saying that they could not take a side in the debate about Big City Coffee and the owner's vocal support of law enforcement and the backlash over that support. They could not take a side in the First Amendment debate that was taking place on campus. But in effect, Big City was asking Boise State to side with the business and take their side on this whole debate over campus law enforcement, which is a big topic on campuses all over the country. So motion to dismiss, hearing coming up on December 2nd. It'll be interesting to see what the judge decides to do with it.
Yeah, I think so. And Margaret, can you talk about the Ada County Coroner? They were set to get a new facilities, right? New office, new facilities. And now the timeline is kind of not necessarily on track.
Yeah. So we're going to have a lot longer to wait before we can get a new coroner's office. And let me just set this up by saying Coroner Dottie Owens has been pushing and pushing and pushing for a new coroner's office for years, even before the pandemic. Their current facility is like half of a warehouse that is partially used by the sheriff's office. It was last updated in 2002, and they had issues with the lack of storage space for the deceased, cramped work areas, outdated circulation systems, if I remember right. They also had a problem with not having a really professional space for families to come and identify the dead. Because there wasn't room for there to kind of be a separate area for that. So families didn't, you know, maybe feel even more upset because of the environment. So Coroner Owens has been really pushing for this. And finally in 2020, I believe, the Ada County decided they took out a special loan to get some money for it, but because they put the project out to bid, but because the expenses are so high, they had to put it back out, look for another bid to see if they can get the price down into what they can afford. And there's also issues with the supply chain, getting some of these really specialized tools and workstations and equipment. So we probably won't see a new coroner's office until the end of 2023. And it would not surprise me if it comes in even more over budget, because construction prices are only continuing to rise as, you know, materials are going up. Staffing is an issue. I mean, this is a story plaguing municipal governments that goes back, you know, 5 years. Every year, things get more expensive. And so we'll see how this gets done. And the Ada County Commissioners tell me this is a priority and they really want to get this done. So we'll see what happens. I'm going to keep watching this project.
So, Kevin, what is the latest in regards to Idaho colleges and universities following the federal vaccine mandate that's coming down?
Well, yes, I'm working on a follow-up story on that. And Kelsey knows this because she heard me leaving a message for a source while I left my... Well, I left my Zoom on unmuted after the sound check. But anyway, here's the story. So we know right now that we have this executive order from the Biden administration, and it's a really serious big deal, that requires all federal contractors to get their employees vaccinated in order to receive federal contracts. And we know that Idaho's three universities are federal contractors because they receive $89 million in research money from the feds. What we don't know at this point is how far reaching that order really is on the campuses. And the State Board of Education this week told the universities, you have to go ahead, or you should go ahead and be prepared to implement this while the state and other states go to federal court to try to overturn this executive order. So you've got the university scrambling right now to figure out, okay, exactly how many employees are we talking about, and how many students, but that gets complicated too. University of Idaho is telling me that they are interpreting the order to apply to every employee on the campus. That's 5,500 employees. Whether they work on a federal contract or not, they could eventually come into contact with somebody who is a federal contractor. So they are interpreting it very, very broadly, as other universities are doing. Boise State, it's not quite as clear. They sent me a statement earlier today that went out to the campus community saying that they think the order will apply to many employees on campus. Doesn't necessarily say all employees on campus. Students not necessarily are going to be covered or affected by this unless they're employees of the university. When you think about it, there are a lot of college students who are on work study programs who are university employees. So they may or may not fall under this as well. So it's a very complicated order. The implementation is very complicated. And of course, we've got multiple federal lawsuits that may or may not affect whether this thing ever goes into effect.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey, can you talk to us about a new study that came out recently? This is by some Boise State researchers into missing and murdered Indigenous people here in the state of Idaho.
Yeah, this came out of House Concurrent Resolution 33 in 2020, where they declared the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women as a crisis and designated May 5th as a day of awareness to help call attention to this issue. And that helps provide some funding for a study out of Boise State to kind of more or less gather data from what is already publicly available, but had not been assembled ever in a report to determine exactly how many missing people across Idaho are Indigenous and kind of break it down by sex and all those different things. So what they found was that among non-Native people, the majority of people who are missing are over the age of 21, and about 60% of them are male. And among Native people in Idaho, it's like the inverse. Approximately half of them are under the age of 21, and 75% of them are women. And so this, the numbers are pretty stark. I mean, it's a matter of more like hundreds of people than thousands, but it's still a very big issue that has really never received much attention until now. And Idaho, I think, is the seventh state ninth state to do one of these statewide reports. And it's kind of the same story in all the other states that they've done these studies in. It's very disproportionately women and disproportionately Indigenous people. And we have five tribes here, I think, who are affected by that.
And Margaret, we have just about 2 minutes left. So quickly update us on the Eagle Water Company maybe selling to Suez.
Oh man, this is a challenge. Can I talk about this in 2 minutes or less? So for many years, some customers in Eagle, only a few thousand, had the Eagle Water Company locally owned. And there has been many years of talks of the company trying to sell. This goes back to 2007. I won't recap all of it because we'll be here for hours. the company tried to sell to a couple developers in conjunction with the city of Eagle. There was a back and forth. There was an old agreement. And ultimately what happened was last year it was announced that Eagle Water Company was going to sell to Suez. And this spiked a lawsuit from the city of Eagle, who sued the company and said, hey, you're violating an agreement that we had saying that the city of Eagle had a right of first refusal to purchase the company. And now Mayor Jason Pierce ran on wanting to buy the company. He won the election. And then in January, earlier this year, city council and the mayor opted to settle the lawsuit for $1.75 million and let Suez buy the company. And now the Public Utilities Commission is trying to decide if they will allow the purchase to happen. And this would spike rates for Eagle customers who previously had Eagle Water. The rates would go from roughly $12 up to $40 a month. And so a lot of residents are against this for various reasons. And so we'll see what the PUC decides.
I want to thank all of you for all of your reporting. It has been a busy week, so I appreciate you taking time out of your day. Many thanks to our panel, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News. Thank you all. Really always appreciate you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks. Have a good weekend. We've earned it.
Yeah, that is true. And I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. Couldn't do it without you. So thank you to all of our listeners. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. Our executive producers, Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Friday. Thank goodness. I hope you have a really great weekend, and we'll see you back here next week.